Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, national and global, shaping our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, what we buy, what we pay, and all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I teach at the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns of analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. If you're interested in the topics, the analyses that you hear on this program, please be aware that you can get much more of this freely at the websites that we maintain. The first is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info, all one word. There you will find documents, analyses, audio, video, all the records of these programs, the archives, a vast treasure trove of materials you may find useful, available to you 24 hours a day and at no charge. It's also possible, using either or both of the websites, to send us questions, comments, and messages. We welcome them. We read them, and we use them to shape this program, and even to select a very few of your questions to respond to on the air. So you can reach me at any time through the websites rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Let me turn, then, to the updates for this edition of Economic Update. I know you may be bored already by all the hoopla around the government shutdown in the United States, but I thought I might add a dimension you may not encounter in the mainstream media. And that is the following. Whether you're focused on the shutdown because there's no budget, that's what began with October 1st, or you're worried about the looming problem scheduled for October 17th, when the government will be at risk of being in default because the Congress has refused to allow the government to borrow more money and it literally won't have enough to run itself if it doesn't do that. If you're worried about that, part of what you're worried about, you should understand, is a big political theater in which the Republican Party plays to its base by seeming to be tough, and the Democrats play to their base by seeming to want to take care of people rather than have the Republicans shut the government down. It's a blame game, and you can see that 24/7 as this thing lasts. You should be aware historically that this kind of shutdown has happened many times in the past, just like threats not to raise the debt ceiling has also happened many times in the past. Shutdowns have lasted from 1 to 21 days, so we are actually at the early stage of how long this one might last. Who knows? But here's what I want to emphasize. The Republicans are trapped, in a sense, by their way of dealing with the United States. Their role, at least for the last half century, has really been one basic program. They want everyone in America that they can reach to blame the economic problems of this society not on the economic system we have, not on the businesses, particularly the large corporations that are so dominant in this economic system. Instead, they want everyone's upset with the economic system to be focused on the government. The government is the bad thing. The government is the scapegoat. The government is the cause of it all. Now, I'm the last one to defend the government in this United States because I see it as an institution supporting, facilitating the way this economic system works, which is hardly a surprise. But it is absurd to focus on the government as the sole cause, as the ultimate bad guy. It really begs the question, why does the government do whatever it does? The Democrats are, of course, different. Their idea is that the problems of the economic system, which have to do with how capitalism works, need the corrective hand of the government. So they like to say the government is a useful partner because it'll make the system work better. Notice, The Republicans want the system to work better by focusing everybody's criticisms and suffering as though it were the fault of the government, whereas the Democrats want to make the system work better by bringing the government in to fix all the ways the economic system doesn't work. So Republicans don't want the government to redirect and redistribute income and wealth. The Democrats wanted to do a little of that because the Democrats are afraid if you let this system work, the inequalities will blow it up. So there you have it. The Democrats have to show we believe in the government coming in because that's the best way to make capitalism work. The Republicans, we want the government to take all the blame, and so we want to punish and shrink the government so the system isn't threatened by that government. Well, what lies behind this? I think the Republicans are afraid. They're afraid that the more people get benefits from the government, the more they will be supportive of the Democrats who favor government help to people. The Democrats are afraid that if they don't take care of the system, make it work better than it otherwise will by government intervention, you'll get a kind of polarized society that'll make this economic system and this society unworkable. It's not clear that either the Republicans or the Democrats have any solution to the problem. You're not going to solve it by having the government do less, and it's not clear you're going to have to solve the problem if the government does more. But that's the name of the debate they are engaged in. And they're fighting it out, and they really don't care that there are hundreds of thousands of employees of the government not getting paid, at risk of never getting paid, forced to work without pay. All of that's going on now. They're not concerned about all the people suffering if the government isn't spending the money that everybody has counted on and paid the taxes to pay for. No, no, no. They're working out their dispute about how to protect an economic system, keep it going, when that system is not working for the majority of the people. That's the underlying problem. And these two parties are fighting. Neither of them deals with the underlying economic system whose problems are what cause all of this. Let me turn next and quickly to another economic update. And this has to do with something that happened in France over the last week. On the 30th of September, the National Assembly, the lower house of the parliament in France, passed a bill. And because the Socialist Party of France is the dominant party in the National Assembly and the dominant party in the Senate of that country and occupies the president, François Hollande, is the socialists dominate the government in France. And they have now for a while. Since they passed this bill in the National Assembly, it's a foregone conclusion that it will likely pass in the Senate and will be signed by Mr. Hollande. What does this policy do? Something very, very interesting and something that does not exist in a number of other capitalist countries. The bill will give workers' councils. Every enterprise, larger than the very small ones, has a workers' council. Workers elect from among themselves a council. And it has all kinds of responsibilities. And this new bill gives them the following. The council can name its own accountant to go over the books of their own company. That's already an amazing thing. And when and why? If the company threatens to sell or to sell out to another company. In other words, if we have what's called a merger or an acquisition. In this case, a French company might be acquired by another French company or a foreign company. The fear of the French working class is that when that happens, the new company that takes over the targeted company, the acquiring company, may shut the factories down, close the offices, lay off people. And the workers don't want that to happen unless an effort is made to find another acquirer who will commit not to fire workers, or maybe even to consider having the government take it over, because in France that's possible, or maybe to have the workers themselves form a workers' co-op. They want those options. They want to make sure that the targeting, the acquiring company is not committed to destroy jobs. And now these working councils, worker councils, will have the power to investigate the books of the company, to make sure that there's a public announcement that they're up for sale for at least 3 months. And the Workers' Council will be able to go to court and stop acquisitions if they don't approve of what their implied result will be for jobs. To make a long story short, the Socialist Party has kept to its word to the working people of France who elected it to begin to systematically protect workers against the profit-driven behavior of corporations that has in the past threatened them with job losses. It's a very interesting example of how and when and why government can sometimes side with worker interests against capitalist interests. And the capitalists of France and their spokespersons are screaming bloody murder. They don't want it. They want the government to do what they want. They want to talk about profit being important. They want to talk about how good it will be for the French if foreigners buy their companies. They don't want the workers to have a say in this. And so they're upset. But that's the way it goes. And that's how the French are protecting their jobs in a way that other countries who don't have worker councils and who don't have laws like this are unable to do. Next economic update that I thought would be of interest to you. There is a record keeper in the United States, a private enterprise, called the Land Report. The Land Report. And one of their recent publications talks about the 25 biggest landowners in the United States. And I wanted you to take a look at what this document reveals. We don't have much time, so I'm going to focus on the two biggest landowners in the United States, the two individuals who own more land than anyone else in the 300-odd million American population. You won't be surprised to know that both of these individuals are in the top 1%. You won't be surprised to know that both of these individuals are among the Forbes magazine 400 richest Americans. That won't surprise you. So here are the statistics. Ranked number two, Ted Turner. He owns the Turner Broadcasting System, basically, which is the parent of the CNN network and several other cable programs. Forbes magazine estimates his net worth at $2.1 billion. He owns, get ready folks, 2 million acres. One man owns 2 million acres in 12 states of the United States and in Argentina. Most recently, he acquired the 8,800-acre Nonami Plantation, known for quail hunting in his native state of Georgia. This year, he also bought the historic Sierra Grand Lodge and Spa in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. And in the number one position, largest landowner in the United States, is John Malone. He owns 2.2 million acres. He is listed by Forbes magazine as having a net worth of $6.7 billion. His corporation is called the Liberty Media Corporation. They own Sirius XM Radio, Barnes & Noble, and a whole host of other properties. In 2011, he purchased by himself 1 million acres of woods in Maine and New Hampshire. This year, he added an Irish castle outside of Dublin and two properties in the Florida territory where horses are raised and run. Biggest landowners, individuals in our economic system able to purchase and own and exclude everyone else they wish from millions of acres. It's stunning, and I thought you might be interested. The last is really a short update, but it goes to proving yet again with another statistic that this country's economic situation cannot be described by the word recovery. And here's a statistic that you might want to pay attention to. There is a growing preference of American shoppers in grocery stores, in food stores, no longer buying national brands of foods, but instead buying the store brand. going to Stop and Shop and buying the Stop and Shop brand, or the Food Emporium brand, or at Walmart, the Walmart brand, or at Trader Joe, the Trader Joe brand. Why? When a company that runs a grocery store puts on the shelf a food with its own name on it, it is saving huge amounts of money. It doesn't have to advertise all over the country to get the name recognition for the brand. And so it's able to put the can of peas or the loaf of bread or the pint of ice cream up there at a lower price because they don't have to spend on advertising. This offering of a lower price is going to be particularly interesting to people whose budgets are pinched. If there were a big recovery in the United States, you might expect less purchase of store brands or house brands, as they're sometimes called, and more purchase of the better known but more expensive national brands. Nothing like that is happening. A straight line over the last 6 or 7 years, more and more people are buying the cheaper house brands rather than the highly advertised national brands. Explanation, simple. No recovery. People's situation is more and more pressed, and if they can save a little bit on their grocery, on the food they have to buy in the supermarket, they will do so. And they will discover the joys of a cheaper brand, even if it isn't the famous one that gets all the celebrities advertised on the radio. Okay. Let me turn then, as we often do at this point in the program, to a discussion of a major topic that is shaping the economic realities of our day. And I want to talk about the way capitalism is working. It's really what the underlying problem is, causing the government to break down, causing our political system not to work, causing the polarization in America between, if you like, the Tea Party on one end, the Democrats, and Occupy Wall Street in some sense on the other end, and lots of folks in between wondering which way to go, how to express their upset at what's happening in the economy, and how to begin to act to deal with it. That's a problem of our economic system not working. So I want to go over why it's happening and how it's happening. First, what exactly is happening? And here I have to repeat something I have said before, but it bears repetition. Capitalism as a system is relocating itself from one part of the world to the other. And this has to be understood and faced. Capitalism grew up about 300 years ago, first in Great Britain, and then spread to the rest of Western Europe, and then to the United States, and then to Japan. Those are the three areas, Western Europe, North America, and Japan, where capitalism grew in its first 200, 300 years. That's where it was concentrated, that's where it was profitable, and it developed. Along the way, it put working people into terrible conditions, and they eventually fought back against overcrowded cities, against unsanitary homes, against inadequate wages, against child labor and women's exploitative work, etc. And slowly over time, a deal was worked out. The capitalists would plow their profits back in, become richer and richer, but they had to share some of the growing wealth with the workers who in the end produced it. And that was took the form of raising wages. So over 200 years, the wages and therefore the standard of living of workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan rose. Until by the 20th century, and certainly by now, the standard of living in Western Europe, North America, and Japan much higher than the standard of living in Asia, Africa, Latin America, etc. But in the 1970s, this reality was accompanied by technical changes. Jet engine travel that would allow you to get from one corner of the globe to another in a matter of hours. And modern telecommunications, the internet, email, all of that. The ability, therefore, to move around the planet in ways you never could before, and to communicate around the planet in a matter of seconds. That allowed a company in New York to control a factory in Bangladesh as easily in terms of monitoring it and controlling it and dictating what happens as it used to be able to do with a factory 50 yards away. It became possible for capitalism to become mobile. And mobile it went, because the capitalists understood that with the opening to them of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, they would have the chance to become much more profitable than they otherwise could, because they could get rid of high-cost workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and move to low-cost workers in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. No rocket science needed to understand this. Since capitalists are driven in their competition with one another and in their desire to capture ever larger shares of markets, they're driven by profit and profit considerations. They could make more profits where wages were low than where wages were high. So capitalists began leaving, this is the point, leaving Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and setting up shop instead in India, China, Bangladesh, Nigeria, Brazil. You get the picture. What were the consequences of this? In Western Europe, North America, and Japan, the consequences were abandoned work sites, factories shuttered, offices closed, stores abandoned. And with the jobs leaving, wages began to stop rising in Western Europe, North America, and Japan the way they had for the previous 100, 200, 300 years. That's the reality. Not only did wages go down, but we had wastes of resources, empty factories, which you can see all over Western Europe, North America, and Japan, abandoned malls, abandoned stores, empty offices, wasted tools, equipment, raw material, floor space, you name it. Waste of materials, lower wages, growing unemployment, and broken cities. As the businesses leave, the revenue of the cities collapses. Unemployed people can't pay an income tax. Destroyed communities don't buy from one another. They don't pay sales tax. They don't pay income tax. The cities, the towns, the states are pinched for revenue, so they begin to cut back on social services. They cut back on teachers. They cut back. You get the picture? Capitalism is abandoning the areas which were favored before. The same profit-making logic that made capitalism work in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, that made capitalism give rising wages to workers who demanded it because they were making so much money, that same profit logic has now decided it's better to be in Asia, Africa, and Latin America and to abandon Western Europe, North America, and Japan. The question is, therefore, what do you do about an economic system, capitalism, that has decided it's got greener pastures somewhere else? It was one thing for Americans, Europeans, and Japanese to come to terms with a capitalism during the phase when it at least raised their wages. It's an open question whether that was the best thing working people could have done, but they did it. But now we have a new question. Is capitalism an acceptable system when it isn't delivering you the goods, when it isn't delivering you rising wages and a rising standard of living? It's doing that in Asia, Africa, and Latin America for workers there at much lower wages. For workers in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, the question is, how do you feel about a capitalism driven by profits, making decisions that have to do with a economic result, let's call it, that is not good for you or your family, or your children accumulating debts to get a degree that isn't going to get them a good job anyway? How is this going to be handled by the American people, the European people, and the Japanese people? Because that's the reality now, and that's the reality into the foreseeable future. Now, why do I hammer this home? Because it's also the case that profit-driven movement of capital is very problematic in China, India, Brazil, Nigeria, and the other places to which the capitalists are going. Here's the irony. As the capitalists go there, they're reproducing the history they had once in the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. Horrible conditions as masses of rural people in those parts of the country flood into the cities looking for work, trying to get a bit higher wage than they used to have to live with, which is what incoming capitalists bring them. The result is terrible conditions for people. Cities that cannot provide basic services to large numbers of people. And wages that are so low that the profit extra for capitalists is enormous because they're paying the lower wages. And so you produce unbelievable wealth. China had as many millionaires produced last year as Americans did, even though as a country the mass of people are much poorer. You're having inequality of income in both the advanced world and the world to which capitalists are now moving. Extreme inequality everywhere is the benefit of capitalism. The people in Asia, Africa, and Latin America are observing inequality that even rivals our own here in this country. It's as if the movement of capital has really helped the top 1% everywhere at the expense of 99% everywhere. It's extraordinary. The irony is, for the first time since this slogan was coined by working people, it actually applies. Workers of the world unite. You don't have much to lose, and you have a world to win. So here's the question. Is there something that we can talk about in terms of this movement of capital from the Western Europe, North America, and Japan to Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and so on? Yeah, there's another dimension. It's the environmental or the ecological. As capitalism leaves the United States, as the capitalists go where profit takes them, they leave behind a society that is so pinched, so troubled by unemployment, by home foreclosures, by deteriorated cities such as we've talked about, Detroit, Cleveland, Camden, my hometown of Youngstown, Ohio, and so on. There's no time and no money to deal with ecological issues. They're pushed under the rug again, as they have been for so long. Think of it in yet another way. When capitalists leave the United States, Western Europe, and Japan, and go to Asia, Africa, and Latin America, they do so because it's more profitable. But of course, it's only more profitable if the commodities you make, where you pay low wages, can be shipped back to North America, Western Europe, and Japan, where still most of the people with money to buy things still are, even as their societies deteriorate. So there has to be an explosion of what? Movement of goods from places where it's cheap to produce them, because you don't pay wages properly, to the places that can buy them. That uses up the ocean. It wastes colossal amounts of fossil fuels to move products from where they're produced, Asia, Africa, Latin America, to where they're still mostly consumed, Western Europe, North America, and Japan. This absurdity pollutes the air, pollutes the water, wastes resources, and is ecologically highly destructive. Why do we have that? Because capitalists have been free to move to where they maximize profit without regard for the environmental effects. And in the places to which capitalism goes, India, China, Bangladesh, Nigeria, Brazil, Pakistan, and so on, ecological nightmares are unfolding as all the horrors of early capitalism, pollution of the air, pollution of the water, destructive chemical dumping, you name it, are flagrant in all those parts of the world, not controlled at all as the early capitalism was in the West too. So we see the freedom of capitalists to follow the profits, move as they wish, are destructive on multiple levels, both to the parts of the world they abandon and to the parts of the world to which they go. what's the solution? The solution is to change the system. We're now going to take our short mid-program break, as we always do. Please stay with me. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. And I'm teasing you, but I'm saying I will provide you with a solution, if you like, to this specter of a capitalism out of control in the hunt for profits when we return. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff, and I want quickly to remind you that we welcome your comments, your questions, your criticisms, for sure, as well as any other kind of communication you'd like to give us. Please, in order to send us these messages, go to the websites, where there are also many of other kinds of materials that may interest you, either to the first one, rdwolff.com, or our second website, democracyatwork.info. Okay, I promised something in the nature of a solution, and you will not be surprised, at least those of you that listen regularly to this program, to know that my solution is called worker self-directed enterprise. In other words, change the organization of enterprises. Democratize the economy by democratizing the enterprise. What does it mean? It's really quite simple. That the decisions of what happens in an office, in a factory, in a store, in a corporation, should be made by all of the people who work there, not by a tiny minority whom we call today the major shareholders and the board of directors selected by the major shareholders. That tiny minority is making the decisions we just analyzed in terms of their horrific consequences, both for the so-called advanced industrial world, Western Europe, North America, and Japan, and for the places to which capitalism is now moving in its hunt for profits, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. So I want to suggest that here's some of the things that would happen if workers themselves control their enterprises, democratically voted on what to do. First of all, they would not be driven by profits. In other words, it's not that profit wouldn't matter, it would. But profit would be one objective among many others. Let me give you an example of how that might work. Suppose the question was, should an enterprise located, for example, in Lille in the north of France, should it close and move to Shanghai in China? Same issue, should a plant in Cincinnati, Ohio do the same thing? Or a factory in Osaka? Or fill in the blank. Here's what would happen if all of the workers made the decision. The plus about moving would be that the enterprise makes more profits. True enough. No question that if you could get the same work done and sell the goods at more or less the same price, maybe a little less, but pay lower wages, you'd make more profits. But what are the negatives? The negatives which a capitalist corporation doesn't have to pay attention to because it isn't responsible for them. I'll give you some, as I already did. Number one, if you leave, the workers there have no job. It's highly unlikely that if workers made the decision, they would move to another country since it meant giving up their own jobs and incomes. Not likely going to happen. But this is important. If the enterprise stays there, the jobs continue. And if the jobs continue, those workers can make the payments on their homes so we don't have abandoned neighborhoods. If the jobs continue, they pay taxes to the state. So it doesn't have to cut back on the social program. The city won't deteriorate the way it has before. If the workers make the decision, they take into account all the social consequences of moving production abroad. That's precisely what capitalists don't have to do in our society. Even though the example of what the French government did last week, the National Assembly giving workers' councils controls over whether factories are closed, is a step in that direction. But if workers ran the enterprises, we can be quite sure that they would take into account not just the profit, which is a plus, but the lost jobs, the lost state revenue that are minuses, and they would make their decisions accordingly. And I think that's a crucial difference. Number two, suppose workers, self-directed enterprises, workers in control, democratic enterprises, what were the form of enterprises being established in China, India, Nigeria, Brazil, and so on? You know what that would mean? It would mean that the places which are growing would also be benefiting everybody, not just a tiny number. If it's obscene in the United States to have multi-billionaires side by side with millions of people who can't pay for their kids' education, imagine how much more obscene it is in a much poorer country where basic food and clothing are inadequate for the masses of people to also have multi-billionaires. Those countries don't need that, just like we don't need it. And if workers ran the enterprises, they would never distribute in a poor country billions to an individual while the impoverishment of the millions continues. They distribute the benefits of growing production in those countries much more equitably. Just as in the United States or Western Europe or Japan, if corporations were run by the workers in them, they'd never distribute billions to a few people so they could buy millions of acres across the states, etc. They wouldn't do that. They would distribute it much more equally. For those of you interested in the fundamental importance of not allowing gross and obscene differences in wealth and income among the people, both in the Western Europe, North America, and Japan on the one hand, and Asia, Africa, and Latin America on the other, changing the organization of production, democratizing the enterprise, is the best chance we have of doing away with this obscene inequality that we see on display around us all the time. Let me move on and give you yet another example. if workers made the decisions of enterprises and they didn't move them the way we see capitalists doing, because they're not so profit-driven, because they weigh all the dimensions of a move, not just the bottom line on profits, you would also see ecological benefits. Workers would be much more concerned with controlling pollution because they live right there. They wouldn't adopt a technology that did damage that their children would have to breathe or their neighbors would have to drink. They're not making a decision on profit that ignores the ecological consequences because the company doesn't have to pay for them. Workers have to pay in health bills, in death, in sickness, in all the rest. So they're not going to make those kinds of decisions. So we're not going to have wasting our oceans, wasting our air, with all the traffic moving goods produced in low-wage areas to the rest of the world. We don't need that. It's not efficient to do that. It's only efficient if what efficiency means to you is profit. But efficiency was never meant to be defined exclusively in terms of what's profitable to the few. If efficiency has any honorable meaning, it has to do with what's best for the many. And for what's best for the many, that's the inspiration of democracy. So the real question is, wow, democracy is violated when a tiny number of people can make decisions for their profit, even at the expense of what's best for the majority of the people. It has always been an effort of those who defend capitalism to argue that what's profitable is also what's best for all the people. In my opinion, that was never true. But in our day, now, when we observe the abandonment of Western Europe, North America, and Japan by a capitalism that justifies moving to the rest of the world because it's more profitable for a minority. And we can see that when we notice that the minority who own the shares of these companies, the top 1%, are wildly more rich than they were 20 years ago, while the other 99% are nothing of the sort. We can see it happen. What the majority need and want is not what capitalism is delivering. That contradiction, that confrontation, is a major factor changing the world that we live in. And it's important for everyone to know it and to know clearly what's at stake. I turn now to the final section of today's program, where I'm going to respond to two questions that were sent in to us over the last week and a half. And several people sent us versions of these questions, so I'm going to kind of put them together and respond this way. The first question is, could you present an analysis of the elections that happened on the 22nd of September 2013 in Germany? Germany is, after all, arguably the major economy in Western Europe, in the European Union, and therefore a crucial player in the world economic situation alongside countries like the United States and Japan and China and so on. So what happens there is broadly interesting, and I think it is extremely interesting for us to look at it. I also chose to answer this question in no small part because the mass media treatment of the election and its results struck me as very, very poor, even by their standards. So let's begin. What was reported most in the world was the re-election, the victory, as it was called, of Angela Merkel, the leader in the German society of the last years, who is, in a sense, re-elected. Let's take a look at how this re-election actually looks when you look at the vote. I should remind everyone that Germany has, like most European countries, proportional representation. In other words, the seats a party gets in the parliament reflect the percentage of the popular vote it gets when the people of the country vote. That is, for example, not the system in the United States, where it's a kind of winner-take-all. The winner gets the seats, the loser doesn't get any seats. Okay, so that's very important. It means, first of all, that Angela Merkel's party, actually two parties that work together, got a little over 40% of the vote. So the first thing to understand is that a minority of the German people voted for her, not a majority. And that's only a minority of those who voted. It doesn't count the many Germans who didn't vote at all. If you were to count them, then the portion of the Germans who elected their leader is less than 40%. We're getting close to like a third of the German people voted for her. This is a government then that has been chosen by a third of the people. Two-thirds of the people either opposed that government or didn't care enough to vote, and therefore are hardly enthusiastic supporters, to say the least. So if this is a victory, then the word victory has to be very carefully redefined. Number two, the second party came in second, is the German Socialist Party. It got around 25% of the vote. Okay, so now we have a minority government, and the party that came in second is a socialist party. But now perhaps the most interesting fact. The party that came in third is called the Left Party. It is more left-wing than the Socialist Party. One of its slogans that I heard that struck me was the slogan, Germany can do better than capitalism. A remarkable event. One out of 12 Germans who voted for that party, the Left Party, in German, the Die Linke Party. The fourth party was the Green Party of Germany. The Left Party got 8.6% of the vote, and the Green Party 8.4% of the vote. So now let's do some simple arithmetic. If you take the Socialist Party with 25%, and the Left Party with over 8, and the Greens with over 8, you put them together, because arguably that's sort of the left side of the spectrum in Germany, in German politics. You put those three together, they got more votes than Angela Merkel did in the election. So who won? Well, under the rules of German society, Mrs. Merkel is going to make the next government. But she's going to have to do it in coalition with other parties. She used to have a coalition with a right-wing party that you might see as quite similar to the Republicans, and maybe even the right-wing Republicans. Doesn't believe in government, wants deregulation, free markets. That party virtually collapsed. It got below 5% of the vote, and if you do that in Germany, you get no seats at all. So she can't make a coalition again with that party. They really got smashed in the election. Again, Mrs. Merkel won. What kind of victory are we describing here? She didn't win. What happened in Germany is a kind of beginning of a splitting between a left, which got more votes when you put them all together, than Mrs. Merkel, or at least is very close, a society being torn apart, which shouldn't come as a surprise to many listeners, because similar things are happening across the world. That's part of the breakdown of government in the United States, a polarization. And that comes rooted in the capitalist crisis we're in. The economic system is separating people into different groups, contending rich and poor. It's shaking the foundations. That's what's showing up in all these symptoms. But since the symptoms are fighting it out as if this is a question of debt ceiling or Obamacare or any of those kinds of secondary issues, no one is getting at the underlying problem, which is an economic system that is creating such inequalities of wealth, income, power, and so on, that it's becoming impossible to continue our modern society. Let me conclude, then, with the second question I want to respond to. And this question goes like this. Will Obamacare, the new law that has been passed already by the United States government, but is now being held up, that is, the Republicans don't want it to be funded, which in effect means you can't do what you've just passed as a law because the money to do it is not being provided. In our system here in the United States, first you pass a law for a program, and then you pass a law to give the money to make it possible to actually execute that program. And the Republicans are trying to prevent the money from being provided and thereby to undercut Obamacare or the new kind of health insurance. So the question goes this way. If Obama succeeds, if the fight is won by the Democrats and the new Affordable Care Act goes into effect, as it's supposed to, will that really finally solve the problem here in the United States of providing medical coverage for the uninsured? In other words, is one at least comforted to know that if it all passes, if the opposition of the Tea Party and the Republicans is overcome, will we at least, however inadequately, have provided medical insurance for the uninsured? And it's very important that everyone understand that the answer to all of that is absolutely no. No. Not even close. Let me explain. The poorest Americans are covered by a program called Medicaid, to be distinguished from Medicare, which is a program for people over 65 who are eligible for medical coverage by virtue of their age and the contributions they've made across their working lifetime. Medicaid is a program to help people who are poor. Each state is allowed to set up and operate its own Medicaid program. Already a strange act, because it means that helping poor people get medical care varies from state to state. And as I proceed, you'll see how important this is. States can set their own eligibility rate. It's as low as the following. There's a state in which if you earn more than $11 a day, you don't qualify. You're not considered poor enough. If you live in the United States and you have to make do, room, board, clothing, on $11 a day, all I can say is good luck to you. Here's the reality, and there was a very good story, and I want to give credit where it's due, on the front page of the New York Times on October 3rd, detailing this. Here's the reality. The government has just passed a bill that will extend Medicaid coverage, trying to all those very poor people, the poorest in our country, to give them the medical insurance they haven't had up until now by an expansion of the Medicaid program to cover more people so that they get here. These are people without any insurance. Wow. Each state has the right to do it or not do it. Out of the 50 states of the United States, 26, that is a bit more than half, have chosen not to participate. Even though the federal government has committed to pay the entire cost of extending this medical insurance to the poorest Americans for the next 3 years through 2016, and to thereafter pay no less than 90%. So all the states have to do is, after 3 years of paying nothing, pay 10%. 26 states in this country chose not to participate, thereby depriving millions of their citizens of a medical insurance, whether or not Obamacare passes. Now, here's the worst of it. Not only are these the poorest of the poor being denied medical insurance, but the states who denied it, thereby were punishing 9.1% of the poor and the uninsured from getting coverage. 10% of their poorest folk are being denied, even though the federal government pays. And here's the insidious motive behind it. The states don't want to pay that money. Not only that, they don't want to pay for the poorest people to have some medical insurance, even though the government picks up all of the bill for the first 3 years and 90% afterwards. But worse, those states that refuse are basically telling their poorest people, leave our state, go someplace else, go to a state that one of the 24 states that hasn't rejected the new Medicaid, and there you can get some help. The states who are stingy and refuse to take care of the poor are hoping to drive them out, to take people already poor and without medical insurance and force them to uproot themselves from the states they're in and move to the states who aren't that cruel. What a strange comment for a quote-unquote the wealthiest country in the world. What a stunning display of family values country not abiding even by its own strange moral rules. Medicaid is not going to go to millions of people who need it, who will remain uninsured no matter what happens to Obamacare. And that's the reality. Thank you very much for being with me. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. And I look forward to talking with you again next week.
My time, babe. They ain't gonna change. change.